Hey, hi, hello. This is Scriptlock, where we talk about narrative and storytelling in video games. I'm Nick Folkman.
And I am Max Folkman. Today's guests are Melina and Graham Annable. Melina has been a producer and a VO and localization producer at Double Fine on such titles as Brutal Legend, Costume Quest, Stacking, Iron Brigade, The Cave, Grim Fandango Remastered, Broken Age, and Massive Chalice, and many more. Graham has worked as an animator at LucasArts on titles including Full Throttle, The Dig, Afterlife, Outlaws, The Curse of Monkey Island, and RTX Red Rock, and later went on to serve as the creative director at Telltale Games, working on Bone, Sam & Max, and the Puzzle Agent series. Now he works at Leica Entertainment as a story artist, and he was nominated for an Oscar for co-directing The Box Trolls. Welcome.
Hey, guys.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having us.
Wow, it sounds like we've done a lot of things.
And it wasn't all the things, I think, because I think we still left some stuff out.
Okay.
Right?
Yes. Yeah. But before we get started, Graham, could you give Nick and I an oral history of RTX Red Rock?
I worked on that, too, briefly.
You did.
What?
Right. It did.
It's funny. You know, I was thinking about that project, and it's strange. I think it's a good thing, but I mean, when you work on any project, video games, film, you just, in the middle of it, you never know ever how it's actually going to be perceived at the end of it all. And when I think back at actually working on that project, I mean, it was fun. I had a good time working on it. You know, it was like each project's unique, but it was like any other project. We had a good team of people together. I really enjoyed working with Hal Barwood. He was like sort of an odd fit within LucasArts at the time, because he was definitely a guy from sort of old school thinking, and he felt like an actual, more like a film director than a sort of video game project lead. He really ran the team like in a really sort of regimented fashion in a good way. Everybody felt like they were part of the team. And it was the weirdest thing when the game finally finished and came out, and then the sort of absolute non-reaction to it was a little bewildering. I mean, we knew it was kind of an odd, old-schooly, adventure-y, swashbuckling in space kind of thing. We weren't sure, obviously, how well it was going to be received, but it was really weird to have almost like no reaction to it. I remember getting a glimpse of, I guess, whatever the first week of sales had been, and I thought, my alternative comic Grickle outsold RTX.
For people who don't know, RTX Red Rock is like a third-person action game with the lead character has this weird, like, green cyber monocle, right?
Yes.
Yeah, he was on Mars, and the aliens that we designed for that game were, to this day, probably one of the weirdest designs I've ever seen for aliens. They were sort of, like, really tall, headless, long-legged frog creatures with sort of amphibious bunny ears. It was really strange. We had a lot of fun animating those guys, though. Again, it's weird. I mean, you just have fun animating. You have fun making things come together, and you really have no idea at the end of it how anybody's going to look at it. And it's amazing to me over the years, having worked on lots of projects, some of which were successful and some of which were not. And, you know, it's like, if the project's successful, suddenly everybody who ever came in contact with that project has a story and remembers something very specific about the time that they came up with the look of something or whatever. There's all these things. But if the project falls on its face, nobody has any recollection of anything that happened those years. It's like, I don't even know. I don't think I was involved. And it's amazing how everybody just gets as far away from it as they can. But in the middle of it, you just never know.
Melina, what did you do on RTX Red Rock?
I was an assistant producer on it for a very short amount of time. I had just left the sound department in LucasArts to move into the production department. And I was on that project and Full Throttle 2, one of the sequels that never got made. And then I left the Red Rock team to be on Full Throttle 2 exclusively.
We should just go into how you got started right now. So, Leah, could you go back a bit and how you got started into video games?
Sure. Okay, so I got a job. I started in the LucasArts sound department and worked with Michael Land, Peter McConnell, and Clint Pajakian, and bunch of other just like really super talented guys, and I just got hired as their production coordinator, which meant that, you know, I filled out purchase requests, and I tracked time cards, and I, you know, organized team lunches and whatnot. But we also were at a stage where we needed to just overhaul all of our studios at that time. And so I embarked on this crazy, you know, thing to try to get all of our software up to date, you know, get all the rooms, you know, get everybody sort of using the same version of software, get the different, you know, bundles and things that they needed, equipment and hardware and software and all that stuff. And I loved it. I loved working with those guys. They also sent me out, like I was the representative at some of the sort of larger production meetings. I represented the sound department in those meetings, which is how I got to, you know other people in the company, and is why I ultimately moved into the production department, because I really wanted to have, like, sound comes in towards the end of a project, and I wanted to know more about what an entire project cycle was from start to finish. So I moved into the production department and was there for a while, and then kind of went through this crisis where I was like, I don't know what I want to do with my life, so I'm going to quit. And I quit. I didn't have anything else lined up. And then the very next day, I got an email from Double Fine saying, hey, would you like to come talk to us? And I was like, are you kidding me? Of course I would love to come talk to you guys. And so then I joined Double Fine and have worked on everything. I didn't really work on Drop Chord, and I didn't really work on Hack and Slash, and I don't think I really worked on Brazen or Autonomous, but otherwise I've worked on everything at Double Fine. So I came in, and there was like a year left on Psychonauts when I started at Double Fine, and it was right at the time when Majesco picked them up to take over publishing it, and I've been there ever since.
And what were you doing on Psychonauts?
Well, at that point, it was no one had really been managing or tracking any of the sound stuff, and it, like, the whole project was in disarray. And so, like, I felt like any time I shone a light on something, I was like, "Oh my god! Oh, this is organize this, please." So there were things like, you know, the sound files. None of them were organized. There was no database for all of the lines tracking where they were in production. Nobody, it was like just a giant heap of wave files, and some were scratch and some were pro, but no longer used because it was a different actor. And so I went through and cleaned all that up. And then I worked on haranguing Tim to write so that we could record all of the dialogue that we needed for the cutscenes, so we could get the animators back working again, because we did tons of pre-rendered cutscenes in that. And, you know, and then moved on to sort of, you know, localizing it post launch. But yeah, at that point, it felt like everybody was just in the trenches, rolling up their sleeves and just doing whatever they could. And it was awesome, because I had come from a place where I wasn't really empowered to do much of anything. And at Double Fine, it was like, we're so glad you're here. Just, you know, grab a shovel and start digging. And it was awesome to just feel like if I saw something that needed to be done, I could just say, hey guys, I'm going to do that. And they're like, oh, thank God you're going to do that. You know? And it was great. It felt really, I don't know. It felt really good. It was like a boost to like my own like self-confidence and sense of self-worth, that I finally felt like I could contribute something to something that mattered. And I think that's why like Psychonauts is just gonna always have a special place in my heart, because, you know, it was a chance for me to really show myself and a team of people that I could do something and make a difference and be a part of a creative thing, even though I necessarily wasn't doing anything creative myself. I was just sort of organizing the creativity, I guess.
And Graham,
yes.
You have a wide history across many different disciplines. So it's all interesting, but how did you get started in games?
You know, a bit of a fluke. Like when I look at most of my career, it's kind of just circumstantial things happened at the right time for me to be where I ended up. With games, I'll be honest, I was not really aware of LucasArts or their existence. I certainly knew George Lucas, and I was, for a time, pretty heavily into video games, but I'm a pretty old guy, and most of my video game experiences were in arcades and off of the Commodore 64 and just early days of gaming. And I think I kind of checked out of most games by the time the whole adventure game thing really kicked into gear. Like, I think I just missed it. I think I still vividly remember being in college and finishing, I believe it was the second Zelda game. And I had spent weekends and weekends playing that thing and getting to the end. And when I got to the end, and all it was Link, you know, a little 8-bit Link, and the princess sort of doing a little dance, it kind of sunk in that I just needed to take a break from video games for a while, because I'd spent way too much time to get that result. So I really was unaware of LucasArts, but I'd been working in film and TV, in animation, in Toronto, downtown Toronto, up in Canada. And it's always feast or famine, the work in Toronto, or at least it was then, and I think it still is now. It's like you've either got too many freelance jobs and you can't do all of them, or there's no work and nobody's working for months on end. And I had heard that TV animation work in Vancouver was a lot steadier. So I had put a portfolio together and I was getting all ready to make a move to Vancouver, BC, and just try my luck out there. And a friend of a friend called up and said he'd just been hired at LucasArts, and they were more than willing to hire more Canadians, because I guess at the time they were having a hard time convincing CalArts graduates down in LA to come up to San Francisco to work at a video game company, because they're just, I guess for animation students, there wasn't a lot of prestige at that time working in video games. And so they were just desperate to get some animators in the building to help them work on a bunch of the adventure games. So I ended up starting off on full throttle. I was animating stuff. And it was a weird jump. I just finished a gig working on the Goofy movie as an in-betweener and cleanup artist. And that was really intense artistically to keep on characters on model. And the drawing was just really high-level stuff. And then all of a sudden, I was sitting at a desk at LucasArts trying to make Ben Throttle using a mouse and just a bunch of pixels. And it was like, it was just a completely different world. So it was just kind of a fluke, and I thought, I'll be here for maybe a year, and then I will continue my journey up to Vancouver, BC, and be back in film and TV. And suddenly, 12 years had gone by, and I was still at LucasArts working in video games. And it was great. I absolutely I love the fact that I got to meet the people I met there and to work on the projects I did, because, I mean, as far as being an artist and an animator in the video games biz, I mean, LucasArts was a great place to be.
And then how'd you get to Telltale?
Well, Telltale kind of happened because of the doomed Sam and Max project, Freelance Police. I worked with Dan Connors and Kevin Bruner on that project.
At LucasArts.
At LucasArts, with Mike Stemley as well. And we had such a great team of animators on it. It felt like sort of, I don't know, everybody, the chemistry on that team was fantastic. Actually, better than any. And I've worked on a lot of great stuff at Lucas, but that particular team and those people, I don't know what it was, but man, we all knew we were making something incredibly special with the Sam and Max game. And as is famously known for anybody that's paid any attention to the LucasArts history, there was that dreadful day where we were easily over 80% finished that game, and there was. And it was going along beautifully. It was just great. And suddenly it was just an upper management decision that we weren't going to be making those kinds of games anymore. So when that got canned, I mean, it was just devastating to everybody. And in particular, Dan and Kevin, who knew in their hearts or believed in their hearts that there was a place for making these kinds of games and that sort of tone and style of things. And that's when they struck out to do Telltale. And they invited me along for the ride. So once they had sort of set up shop and things were ready, I was lucky enough to get the opportunity to be working at Telltale in those crazy early days. And much like Melina was saying about Double Fine, same sort of thing. I mean, I'd spent over a decade at LucasArts, which was a huge company. And when you're in a big company, yeah, your jobs tend to be very specialized and very specific. And you're not really on the hook for anything else. You just do that one thing and make sure your cog fits into the machine. And that's it. And suddenly working at Telltale with those, you know, there was maybe like, I don't know, eight of us, seven of us working in this really dingy little place in Marin County. And we were doing everything. All of us had to do everything every day. And you had to think on your feet as fast as you could go every day. And it was the craziest time, but it was so exhilarating to do that, especially after so many years of just having to just worry about one or two specific tasks and suddenly having to deal with cooking the whole enchilada every day.
And did you start out as a creative director?
Yes, I believe that was. I mean, I feel like we all handed out it. We all had our titles, but it was just like everybody's title was just do everything and do it now. So yes, for better or for worse, I was listed as creative director at that time.
So what did that mean? What did you do?
Everything. I mean, we were trying to do, you know, conceptual arts. I was storyboarding stuff. I was trying to help design characters. I was trying to work with the programmers on specifically how the assets were going to fit within things. I would be in meetings designing, trying to figure out which design we should go for the company logo. I would get involved with, you know, calling, because I had been doing my own comic work on the side for a few years at that point. And so I had some connections in the comic industry. And, you know, all of us were constantly mining, like, who we knew that we could maybe talk to about possibly making a game out of their license and things. Because that was another big part, I think, of what Kevin and Dan have certainly followed through with, was they wanted to build this company, certainly in the early days, on already existing licenses. They felt like that was the only way to kind of get a jump start and have sort of an audience waiting for something that they could create and then hopefully put themselves in a position later on to do original IP. So anyway, we were just always every day racking our brains of who we knew and who could possibly, you know. So I ended up finding myself on the phone with Jeff Smith of Bone, talking with him and saying, hey, I'm working with a bunch of my friends. We've got a company started and we would love to make a game of your comic. And there was a couple other guys, John Scrow specifically, who was a huge Bone fan. I mean, I knew Jeff Smith. I'd met him. I was certainly aware of Bone and I loved it, but I hadn't actually read the whole series. But John Scrow knew the series inside and out. And so he convinced me to call Jeff and contact him and kind of get that ball rolling. But it was just...
Was it hard to convince Jeff Smith to work with you guys?
I wasn't actually involved when the real like negotiations truly began, but it took a little back and forth for Jeff to just even get his head around what I was even proposing to him, because he didn't have any real sort of extensive experience with adventure games or anything, or even video games in general. I don't think he was like a big video game buff, so he didn't quite know what the heck I was trying to explain to him. But the more Kevin and Dan, I think, stepped him through what we wanted to do with it and how important it was to them to sort of honor the tone of what his books were and all the rest of it, then I think he started to gain confidence that, okay, maybe these guys are onto something that would actually be a nice supplement to the books that he'd created.
Yeah, and for people who don't know, like, Bone is a very important work in comics and very well known and successful. And yes. So making a game out of it was very big,
yes,
at the time.
Yes, and Bone, I mean, Bone is like one of the high water marks within the comic industry of, wow, there's an independent company creator, something like outside of the usual sort of, you know, Marvel DC world. Like, this Jeff Smith truly forged his own way with this really specific and unique comic series that lasted for years.
And at that time, like, there weren't any adventure games being made, like, by anyone other than LucasArts.
Yeah, and I mean, even LucasArts wasn't making them anymore, because they even decided that, nope, nobody wants these kinds of games anymore. This is dead. This is a dead end. We need to move on to other genres. And
I can imagine that, trying to explain to somebody who doesn't know those games, which there aren't any out there, like, really hard to wrap your head around a game where all you do is walk around and look at things.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right, because there was nothing at that time to point to and say, yeah, it'll be a successful game like this. I mean, everything we could point to was like 15 years ago or something. And, you know, as popular as adventure games are amongst gamers, I don't think anybody outside of the gaming industry looks at those things as like, you know, they don't know, they're not household names. They don't know Halo like they know Halo or something like that. None of those adventure games are always a very, you know, it's a very specific audience that really, really got into them. But yeah, you couldn't point at it from somebody outside of the industry and say, yes, it'll be a great financial success like such and such.
Yeah. And you were there for the first year?
Yeah, about the first year and a half, I guess. Well, no, I think it actually ended up about a year exactly, actually. Because, yeah, I left LucasArts 2005. And in January 2006, I was sitting at a desk at Leica trying to figure out how to storyboard. So...
And while you were at Leica, you were still like consulting for the Puzzle Agents series.
Yeah, that sort of happened a little after. I mean, you know, I was I was over my head trying to figure out how to storyboard on Coraline for the first year up in Portland, but I never lost track of Telltale, and I always, you know, I mean, I'm good friends with Kevin and Dan, and so we would continue to talk, and I was always, you know, checking in with those guys to see how things were going. And man, you know what it was? I'm trying to think, like, how did Puzzle Agent even occur? It was because of Melina, when I think about it, because you got really into playing that Professor Layton series on your Nintendo DS. And I was kind of in the middle of making those YouTube animated shorts that I'd been doing, and when I saw her playing that game, I was like, oh my god, that is what I want to do something like that next, because the way Professor Layton worked, it was familiar to the sort of adventure game model that I had known, but I had now, like, through doing the animated shorts on YouTube, I had an animation style that I thought would really fit nicely with that, and it just, the whole idea of trying to put a project like that together really excited me. So I made a little animated short specifically to pitch the whole idea of Puzzle Agent to Kevin and Dan. And it just, again, circumstantially, it just perfectly aligned with them beginning what they called the pilot program. They, you know, like I said, Kevin knew he wanted to start that company doing existing licenses, but he wanted to try to get into a realm where they could do original IP as well and just try out different projects and things. And so he had just recently told me about this pilot program they'd wanted to start, and I thought, man, I'm going to just for the heck of it, I roll the dice, I'm going to put a little thing together and do a pitch to him. And it just, yeah, it was just sort of the right thing at the right time for them to sort of experiment with.
And it's still the only original IP that Telltale's done?
Yeah, it's funny though, on forums you see people arguing, is it truly an original IP? Because at that point, I wasn't part of Telltale anymore. I was technically an outsider bringing yet another license in, but it certainly wasn't an established thing. I mean, my audience for the Grickle comics and animated shorts is not like Jeff Smith's Bone or Batman or anything like that. So it's pretty small potatoes. So it's kind of in a gray area. It's kind of an original IP, and I like to think of it like that for them. But yeah, I don't know if you really wanted to be technical about it. I suppose it's another license that was brought in.
So do you own Puzzle Agent, or is Telltale own Puzzle Agent?
It's kind of a split ownership of it.
Okay.
The way it was structured.
Interesting.
Yeah.
All right. We're going to talk more about the pilot program and Puzzle Agent, but first we got to get back to Melina.
Yes, please. Yes.
Melina, how would you define a producer? Like what their job is? Because we continue to hear lots of differing definitions for what they do.
I feel like I could sum up my job is that I am a helper. If I need to, you know, my job is to help people on the team, and if I'm not helping, then I'm not being a producer. Because I am not the one who's writing code, and I'm not drawing the concepts, and I'm not animating or modeling or any of those things, it is my job to make sure that those things go as smoothly as possible wherever I can. And if I foresee a problem, to try to smooth the way. Like, I'm a bottleneck remover and a helper. And I'm the champion for the team. I feel like there's a lot of producers who are failed designers, or there are producers that just like to issue commands and retreat to an office. And I think that those are both really terrible things. That really what you need to do is you need to like sit amongst all the people and listen to the things that they say. And when you happen to overhear something, like, I can do something about that. And then you step in and you do that and you take care of it. And you know, it's kind of like an expediter in a restaurant. It's like, make sure that all of the food is served warm and, you know, cooked perfectly. I just want to help people.
You're kind of a cat herder, though.
Too. A cat, but also a cat herder, too, because it's really easy for projects to get off the rails. So your job is to get a project on the rails, define it, you know, kind of work with everybody to sort of figure out, like, okay, what is the scope of this thing? And then make sure it just stays on the rails until it's done. And you do a lot of really unglamorous things. I also really liken the job to that of a janitor, and that is... when you are doing your job well, nobody notices. But if you're not doing your job well, then everybody notices. Like, you know, you go into a gas station bathroom and a toilet is covered with unsavory substances. You're like, God, where's the janitor? This is disgusting. And that's kind of like the role of a producer. It's not very glamorous. But... yeah, because like when the job is going well, people on the team are like, yeah, we're so awesome. Yeah, like our programmers are great. Our animators are great. You know, we've got really great voice actors. We've got all this stuff that's awesome. No one ever says, and our producer was top notch. Like, you're just kind of invisible. But if a project goes really poorly, then that's when people point to... you know, the project lead or the producer or management to go, that was a terrible project. It's all their fault because they effed it up. So it's kind of thankless, but I don't care because I really like working with people on creative projects. So I don't really care what, I don't know. I'm also just like a low on the radar kind of person. I don't need a lot of like fame or whatever. I don't need to have a name on the internet. I don't know, the fact that I'm even talking to you guys and this is going to go out on the internet, like, I'm a super private person.
We know. It was hard to find info on your credits on the internet.
I'm just kind of a quiet person. I mean, I'm part of a team effort. I don't feel like there's anything that I do that is better or worse than anything else that anybody else on the team does. We all work together to get something amazing done.
What is an average day of work on one of those amazing products to work on?
Oh my gosh. Well, because right now I'm working on multiple projects, I feel like I'm pulled in multiple directions. But you can have a list of things on a notepad that says, you know, here are the things that I need to do for each of those projects. And then at the end of the day, you can look at that notebook and you've done none of those things, but you've written down a bunch of other things that you had to do and that you did. So you have to just be really flexible and roll with the punches and just do whatever needs to be doing and then chip away at some of the larger things, you know, kind of as you find time to do them. I don't know. I jump from answering questions from translators to casting, like working with Chris to cast actors for something, to getting dialogue put into a dialogue database, to reading contracts, like really boring stuff, like really boring legal stuff, like writing contracts, reading contracts, whatever needs to be done, I'm going to do it. And so that's why I can't really say what a typical day is. It's like, just do everything to the best of your ability.
And none of this is really out of the ordinary for what a quote-unquote normal producer would do in the games industry?
I don't think so, but, you know, I know that we've interviewed people who are like, I'm the producer of UI and Fire. Like, well, that's great. So, well, what happens when the producer of weapons needs to have, like, some fire muzzle something?
Yeah.
Like,
what if we bring in water?
Yeah, what happens? Like, it's... I don't know. I think at larger companies, you know, Graham said it earlier that, you know, you kind of have a specialized role and you just have to make sure that, you know, that you fit into the overall machine of things. And so maybe at larger studios, you can get away with just doing one small little thing and never doing anything else. But at a smaller studio, I think you have to be willing to wear a lot of hats and sort of exploit your own talents and exploit everyone else's talents. I mean, when we do the Amnesia Fortnite projects, you know, we might have an animator who says, you know what, I just really want to see if I can do special effects. Go for it. You know, like, I don't feel like we ever say no to somebody, because if someone is saying, this is something I want to do, it's probably because we need someone to do that. And they're saying, I'm stepping up to the plate to do this. So to answer your question about being a producer, like, I don't know. I hope that there are producers that just jump in and do everything and help the team, but there probably aren't. I feel like I've interviewed a lot that are not very good.
Would you prefer to be more specialized, or do you think it's better or worse that you're covering more things?
That you're wearing many hats.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I like the challenge of doing creative and interesting things. And part of what keeps things creative and interesting is that they're always changing. There are certainly some things that I feel like I do really, really well. And that's fine. So when a situation comes up, it's like, okay, all right, I got localization handled. Or like, I know we have this great dialogue database. Like, I'm not concerned about having the dialogue managed in any, you know, like, I got all that stuff. It's the problems arise from, you know, not having a script ready, or I don't know. I like doing lots of different things, and to me that's just part of the fun. And I suppose there are some people that would prefer to be more specialized, and that's totally fine. I would prefer to keep things interesting.
And do you feel like there's anything else different for your job about working at one of the last mid-range studios out there, where you don't have as much room to stretch as a AAA developer, but you're still not stretched like so thin like a indie studio?
Yeah, well, I think it keeps things interesting. It keeps us like having to stay, to come up with creative and interesting solutions to creative and interesting problems. We can't solve the problem by just throwing more resources or money at a problem. We have to think about, well, how can we honor the game and what the vision is for the game with what we have? So I like it. I like that, you know, we're forced to be creative in how we solve problems that come up. And, you know, sometimes things are really gross and ugly, and we just kind of look at each other and like, well, we're all in it together. I mean, I work with some really fantastic people, and I know that, you know, when things are going to be rough, that we're just going to roll up our sleeves and get it done.
Do you think there's any, or do you have any idea why there aren't more mid-range studios out there, why so many have died off and there aren't more successful AA studios?
Well, I feel like, you know, the business of video games is really, really big. I can't really speak for, you know, all the different companies and the various business decisions that get made, but I feel like, there's so much risk. And when budgets get bigger, people get more and more risk adverse. And I think that big studios are going to keep making the big, you know, big games with the big budgets and the big teams, because that's what they've done in the past. And they're building on IP that is established and known out there to the public. And I think it's harder for smaller studios to compete with that and find funding from larger publishers. So I think it just becomes like, you know, we're forging our way the best way that we know how. And yeah, and there's so much out there. Like, I'm playing some games right now. I'm super into Shooty Skies right now. And then sometimes I'll just watch the ads because I don't want to pay the coins to continue. And I see so many ads for so many games, like, that I have zero interest in playing. Like, cooking games. Why would I want to play a cooking game? Because I would rather cook in real life. I don't know. It's hard. I think it's hard to stand out. There's so much stuff out there. And there's so many small independent studios that are trying to do their thing. And I think that's great. And they should keep doing it. And there's big studios that are doing their big, giant things that make people happy. And they have marketing budgets that are bonkers. I don't know. It's a really good question. And I don't really have an answer.
Fair enough.
We'll figure it out sometime.
Okay.
Graham, to ask you a question now.
Sure.
So Telltale, at the beginning, they were the first studio, at least, to say and actually do it about making like episodic games.
Mm-hmm.
Was that, like, did they know they were going to do that right at the beginning?
Yep. That was definitely part of the deal. And it's funny to look at it now because it's such an established, feels like it's such an established format and a way of doing things. But again, credit to Kevin and Dan in the early days. They knew or presumed or hoped that the way things were going to be done on the internet was shifting to much more being downloadable content. I think Kevin just understood that with, you know, the continuing growing bandwidth that people were going to have with internet stuff, it was just going to become more of the norm that you were just going to download things as opposed to physically buy copies of stuff. And he wanted to be that company that would be at the forefront of that. He wanted to sort of roll the dice because he saw things going that way, and he felt like he could be that company. They could make that company that could provide this kind of content in that sort of format. And I think he always talked, both Kevin and Dan always talked about trying to emulate television more than video games in a way, in terms of the way I remember his descriptions of, like, the website would operate like an HBO or like a TV, like NBC or something. You would just go to the website, the Telltale website, and pick your favorite show and download it and watch it that way. And it's just, again, back then, like 2005, 2006, that seemed like maybe, I guess. And now it's just like it's a foregone conclusion. I mean, it's just that's the way everybody does it now. It's like everything's shifted that way, film, TV, games, all of it. But at that time, it was a little bit of an odd idea. It sort of made sense, but no one had actually done that really on a big level. So it still was kind of unknown territory. But yeah, Kevin and Dan were willing to try to sail that direction and also simultaneously try to revive a genre of game that they felt strongly about, which was adventure games. So it was a couple of things kind of combining into what became Telltale.
What was it like trying to figure out the workflow at the beginning? Were they breaking the whole story of all the games together before they started production?
No, we took Bone one step at a time. I mean, we all had worked, you know, recently on the Sam and Max game at LucasArts. We'd also worked over the years on all of us that had our sort of fair share of working on adventure games. And so the structure of Bone was pretty familiar. I mean, we certainly had to create our own technical pipelines, and Kevin had come up with this whole, I forgot the name of it now.
The chore tool.
Thank you. Which was like his way of expediting creating an adventure game and making it much more accessible for artists to do more and be more involved in the technical process without having to have a whole bunch of programmers reinterpret things and try to set it all. And it worked pretty great. So we had a lot of experience making that, but we knew, again, Bone, we were pretty tentative, I guess, in our big picture ideals. We just knew we had the opportunity to get that first chunk of the story done, and we just focused on that. And it was like, you know, it's like hopping from one stone to another across a stream. We just focused on one rock at a time to get a little further across that stream. And, you know, always best intentions and hoping that we'd be in a position to do more later. But, Yeah, we didn't go into it thinking we will do the entire universe of Bone in one fell swoop and figure it all out. We knew that wasn't going to be exactly realistic.
I'm also curious, like, when the company was first starting out, mm-hmm. was there anything when you were thinking about making the games that you were unsure about that have, like, now become mainstays and what makes a Telltale game like a Telltale game?
Definitely, I don't think anybody was completely sure about anything. You know, again, we were starting to put everything into making these games that had up to that point been everyone said were dead. There was no way, there's no reason to do them. So we didn't exactly go into this into it with a ton of confidence, but we just knew. Again, it always gets back to, for me personally, it's always like, I think the best barometer of making anything, at least as an artist, is like, if I like it, somebody else is going to like it. I mean, there's always a certain level of, you got to create these things to entertain yourself, or, you know, things that you love are just inherently going to get loved by others. It's just from a financial side standpoint, it's like, as long as there's enough people loving it, at the end you can keep making more of it. But it was, there was definitely not a big sense of like, yeah, we know exactly what we're doing here. We just knew that we all had experience making adventure games, and we thought through the format of downloadable content and just, you know, we knew we had an opportunity to try to evolve that genre. It had more room to grow. But Telltale just found things along the way that worked and discarded things that didn't. I mean, that was actually another big point of Kevin and Dan's, was that doing things in episodic format allowed you to adjust the dial on your product as you went. So if the first couple of episodes of Sam and Max, you know, people started, because as we know, the internet allows for everybody to express their opinion at all times, you start seeing a lot of static or noise about one certain aspect of the gameplay that nobody's enjoying, you can start to dial that down a bit and start to maybe focus on things that, yes, do feel better, you know, that work better. And the product evolves as the story's being told to some degree, much more than, say, when you're making a AAA title and you've locked in a team for like 4 to 5+ years. You know, they don't have any room to, not near as much room to evolve or adjust to what's working and what isn't working necessarily, because as much as you have testers and as much as you look at a thing, when you look at a project and you work at a project internally, just like I was saying about RTX Red Rock, you really don't know at the end how it's going to get perceived. As much as you think you can kind of dictate or articulate or control what the effect on the audience is going to be, you just never know. That's the thrill and frightening thing about it. It's just, you don't know, really. You just do the best you can. You make the product you think will work, and then it goes out and it becomes its own thing as soon as it's out there. But doing the games in episodes allowed us to somewhat tweak and dial and continue to improve upon the things that were definitely working.
How much could they course correct, like, after the first episode comes out? How far was production going along on the next episode after the one before it comes out?
It got faster and faster as we went. So, like I said, it, you know, hopping from rock to rock as you keep building these things, I think we got faster at hopping to the next rock. I can't remember specifically how many episodes ahead we would get. I think by the time they were doing Sam and Max, which was right around the time I made my exit to go to Leica, I'm probably wrong, but I'm thinking at least maybe one or two episodes we sort of had leapfrogged ahead on by the time the first one is out. At least we're at least a couple episodes ahead. And then, you know, it's each whatever the problem was that needed to be get changed, it's just a question of scale. And like, is it a huge flaw in the game that, like, whoa, the ship's a little too big to start steering it the other way with that problem? Or is it smaller things that are easy to implement? You know, it just varies depending on what people are reacting to.
Switching back to Melina, when you're working with writers or just in your own work as a localization producer, what are the worst problems you're encountering?
Well, I think that the worst problem I ever encountered was back at LucasArts, and I think it was Jedi Power Battles. I think it was that game where They did full voice localization. And so at that time, there was a separate voice department and a separate sound department. And why it existed that way is probably a political reason. And it, like, predates my time there. I don't know. Anyway, so the sound designers, the voice department would record the dialogue, edit it. But if there was any special creative processing that was needed, the sound department would do that. And then there was a separate localization department. And so I think it was Jedi Power Battles. I really don't remember. Some Star Wars game. And they did full voice localization. And one character in Italian came back recorded in, like, the wrong gender. And, you know, and it was because whatever localization package got sent out didn't specify the gender of the character. And so I just remember the sound designer coming out of his office, like, I don't know what to do about this one. You know? And, you know, we figured something out, but,
pitch it up or pitch it down, right?
Yeah. Pitch it up, pitch it down. Good. But you know, like, that's when you realize that, that in addition to the creative work, there needs to be some organizational things in place that would, you know, allow that to never happen again. As far as, like, sort of things that I face, on Psychonauts, when we sent the script out, you know, it was like you try to preserve the humor, and so we sent actually a section of the French script back, and we said, no, like, so here's what we're trying to accomplish here, like, please try to preserve the jokes, and if that means that you're not doing a literal translation, that's totally fine. Just, you know, keep the funny. And that's why, you know, there's a notion of localizing versus just translating. Because if you just translate something literally, it might lose the essence of what you're trying to achieve. And so by localizing it, you are keeping the same humor and intent of the English script, but you are making sure that that same original intent and humor and whatever else comes through in the translations, even if it means that the translations have changed. Also, on stacking, like, there was a lot of humor that had to be explained. Like, I had to explain, one of the questions I got was, what is a Dutch oven? We don't think they're referring to a cooking pot. I'm like, these are the things I have to answer. Trying so hard to write an email that's that addresses that. And finally, I just said, go to urbandictionary.com and here, just look at that, because I can't tell you. I can't with a straight face write this in an email.
Did you get a reply?
I did. They thought it was hilarious. Oh, and we also we had a bug on in stacking too, where the literal English translate, you know, the English was, you know, referring to somebody tossing their cookies, like throwing up. And it had been translated literally as, like, throwing cookies. And then the bug got written up as, like, it is clear he's not throwing cookies, he's vomiting. please change it to this. And when something is text-based like that, there was no recorded dialogue at all in stacking. It allows you to play around and fine-tune those things to a greater degree further along in the development cycle. Whenever you add in actual, like, voice recording, well, then you have to get to a point where you lock the English so that you can make sure that the English accounts for all of the natural line changes that happen in the studio. There might be something that comes up in the studio totally off the cuff that totally changes what one of the lines of dialogue is. And so you need to get to a point where you lock that for English and then send that out for translation. If you are voice localizing, then you have to make sure that there's enough time in your schedule to get it all recorded and edited and implemented. So that means that you have to maybe lock your voice script much sooner than you would prefer. And that's a tough thing, because you don't want to get to a point and go, oh my god, but if we just changed this at this point, it would be so much better. But you've already locked the English script, so you can't do it. You have to come up with another way to do it.
To be fair, I don't think any writer would say they've ever given a script for dialogue a way to get recorded to their satisfaction. It's not that they finish, it's that they just run out of time to work on it.
Of course. Oh, I totally agree. And I think that just having enough trust in yourself to say that, no, this addresses the needs of what we need. And yes, a week later I might think of something that's better, but this is what I have to go with.
Right.
And I think that some people work better under that pressure. I know I didn't write
absolutely
term papers in college until right before they were due.
Yeah. Do you have any preference on working with either VO or text, or does it not matter for you?
Well, I think that working with voice is just that much more exciting, because the voice actors that you work with can take a character and change it in ways that you didn't even think of. You read something and you, whether or not you're conscious of it or not, you're applying your own idea of like what that character is and how that character might sound, even if it's just subconscious. And then you get some voice files back and you're like, whoa, this is like way better. It's a cool process, and it's also just a fun thing when you're slogging through a bunch of stuff making a game. When the voice, like the professional voice files come in, it's really fun to just hear how that changes everything for the better.
And speaking of the writing, for the writers out there who are listening, how can we make your life easier, Melina, and producers in general?
So I try to actually be pretty hands-off. Like, I don't dictate sort of how something needs to be written. So, like, Tim does a lot of writing in notebooks, and then he might type it up into, a Word doc or something, and he kind of cuts and pastes, and he moves things around. Anna Kipnis came up with a sort of an Excel-based thing on Psychonauts that just allowed for some color coding and things that sort of would make Tim think about, okay, this is a cutscene, this is kind of gameplay dialogue, this is chatter. And so I don't really care what your creative process is for writing, but for games, it is important to think about kind of how a piece of dialogue is going to be used. So if it's a cutscene, make it clear that that's a cutscene. And sometimes you won't know, and that's totally fine, because things change all the time. Like, oh, you know what? We need to take the last line of that cutscene and put it in the interactive set. That stuff happens all the time, and that's fine. But it's thinking about how you want the dialogue to play. So do you want to have just a bunch of chatter events? It's like if you get close to someone, there's just like proximity chatter. What is that set of dialogue like? How is that different from, say something that gets said, during some, melee or skirmish or, some battle thing, what is sort of like a story based thing that moves the story along, but isn't a cutscene? It's done interactive, and whether, you have sort of dialogue choices that you would make more like from an adventure game, or if it's just certain story beats that have to happen. I guess I would just think about the structure of your script in a way that helps everybody understand what it is that you're trying to achieve. And so making it clear, like, we do a lot of things where, Tim will write something like, okay, then say this, pick one of the following five. So, like, randomly pick one of five. Or go down the list, and then once you've hit the last one, just repeat the last one. And he'll write things like that. And we include that in our script. So like in our dialogue database, so that the gameplay programmers know how to implement it. but it also helps with, because that same script is what we print out and bring into the studio. And it helps the voice actors too. They're like, okay, I get it. You know, that these things, they might build, but, or they might just be totally randomly, like, you don't know which one you're going to get. So I'm going to deliver the line in a different way. And so the more you can state what it is that you're trying to do and how you want this dialogue structured, the easier it is for everybody else to honor what it is that you're doing. And that's weird, because as a writer, you're like, I just want my writing to speak for itself. That's totally cool. But if you want to get the best out of what a team can do, you will sort of walk us through some of this thought process and make it clear to us how it's like, you know, expose the structure and explain to us what you want. And that is super key, I think.
And a great answer. Additionally, are there any common problems that you keep encountering while working on a story-based games, like either creative or production business-wise?
I think each game, each project that you work on presents its own unique challenges and possible solutions. From like a business standpoint, you know, we do our best to make sure that we have enough lines of dialogue written to merit going into the studio, because once you go into a studio, you're committing a large chunk of money. Even a single scale actor, a 4-hour session, it still ends up costing a lot. And so you want to make sure that you've got enough to make it financially worthwhile. And Double Fine is unique in that we have a large number of characters, but each character has fewer lines. And so you come up with this elaborate casting matrix so that you can have one actor do three voices and have those three voices be a financially feasible amount of dialogue to record. It's weird. So we do a lot with Scratch VO, and that allows us to implement things and test things out and sort of see what the reactions are. And then once we have enough dialogue written, then we can go into the studio and be sort of financially, like fiscally responsible with about that. From sort of a creative side, there's always going to be creative problems that come up, and it's figuring out like what I said before of, okay, well, we have to take the last line of this cutscene and make it interactive, or, oh, you know what, we need to take this interactive bit and make it a cutscene, or we have to, you know, find some other way to handle it. And you can't just look at a script and know that. It's when you're actually getting to the meat of implementing something that you realize those things. And for us, we've just honed this dialogue system and pipeline of how we manage dialogue, from it being written and entered into our database to tracking its recording status to, you know, implementing it, that it allows us to, like, over the years we've just figured out, okay, well, that didn't work. Okay, we need to fix it this way. That doesn't mean that there aren't going to be new things that come up that completely flummox us. But I think, you know, there are so many people that have worked at Double Fine for so long that, and especially from like gameplay programmers and people who understand dialogue specifically, that that I feel like we have a wealth of information to fall back on. And that even if we can't say, oh, this is just like whatever, because that never happens, that we can say, this is similar to, how about we solve it this way?
Graham, mm-hmm. As someone who's jumped between so many different mediums, what's kept you interested about games?
I think...
Are you still interested in games?
I am. I jump in and out. I feel like I suffer or benefit from a very short attention span with things. And I feel really fortunate that I've had the opportunities I've had to sort of jump between film, TV, games, comic books. I mean, I've really been lucky enough to sort of follow my nose with whatever has been inspiring me at the time. the thing that I love about games, and there's no competing with the fact that that quality of immersion of the experience. I mean, it's, I'm sure, a very cliche thing to say about games in general. It's pretty kind of a general statement, but it really is true. It's, man, when you nail it right in a game and you get the right vibe for whatever genre it is, there's just a level of immersion that I really think film and even reading books or looking at comics, none of them quite achieve it the same way or to the level that games do. And when I say that, I think specifically about, I think the greatest example of it for me personally is horror games like within the horror genre of, they games scare the crap out of me way more than watching a scary movie. I mean, you just, because you actually have something at stake. You're controlling the little avatar around there.
It's and
you,
true.
He and you screams. Don't want to get attacked.
It's really hilarious.
It's just, there is something about, you know, when you're interacting, when you're actively solving problems within a game, it truly connects you that much deeper, I guess.
What are the horror games that you are most horrified by?
Again, I'm lame. I think anybody in gaming is like, oh my God, really? That's his horror game? The one specifically, and the one that Melina's laughing at about is, the Red Dead Redemption.
The Undead Nightmare?
Yes.
Okay.
That patch or whatever the
expansion.
Put on, expansion, yeah. That's the term. That you could put on it. It's become basically my Halloween tradition now that every year I dig that thing out and I play like a round or two, like, you know, the day before Halloween or whatever at night. And it seems to scare me more now because I was never that good at it to begin with. I've never been really adept in terms of controlling my character and reloading the rifle and all the rest of it. But the fact that now I play it with a year gap in between, I've like completely forgotten any skills I had acquired. But I'm thrust into the middle of wherever I left it off at, which I got fairly deep into the game. So I've got like zombies spitting acid at me and like running and attacking me. I'm just getting mauled from all sides. But the thrill of it, I don't know what it is, man, but it's that thrill of being in that situation. And like film, well, like books, like anything, any form of entertainment, literature, it's about creating that vibe, that feeling, that space. I always think about an interview I read or heard a long time ago with David Lynch, and the whole reason he got into making movies was he just wanted to create paintings that moved. He wanted to recreate that dream feeling that you get when you have a really vivid dream. That was his whole mission, whether he was doing it in a painting or whether he was doing it in a film. And I really feel like that applies to all forms of whether I'm working on a comic book or a video game or a movie. It's like, it's all about just trying to bring you into that space. And that Undead game, man, it's just like the whole decor of like Old West, but it's all zombified and apocalyptic. It's like this perfect blend of, it's delicious the way they did it. The way the sun sets is really weird. And there's just a vibe when you're playing it that's incredible. And I love stepping into that world once a year.
So you still haven't beaten it?
Oh, God, no. I've barely ever completed any game I've ever played. Like I said, I think the last game I probably truly beat was the second Zelda game. So it's been a while. I don't go into these things with any sense of actual success.
You beat Wind Waker.
Oh, that's true. Melina, you're right. I did. I did beat Wind Waker.
All right, that's good.
Yeah.
That's the last one I ever completed.
And to follow up that question, one of your old interviews, you said that, talking about your Grickle comics, that only using words to express an idea scares the heck out of you with regard to your drawing versus your writing. Mm-hmm. Do you think that you could say the same with you doing gameplay?
We could do the same with gameplay?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, again, I have much more confidence in my ability to express something visually than I do through words and text. I just problem solve. I think my way through hurdles, you know, in a visual sense. That's just what I default to. So yeah, again, yeah, if I'm limited to just being able to use my writing or text to try to create a situation or solve a problem, I need to have that visual component to feel confident in getting it done right or getting it at least close to what I could imagine it being.
And since you've been working at Leica, have you had any ideas like of just game ideas like when you came up with Puzzle Agent?
Puzzle Agent's been the main thing and it's still on my mind. I feel like about once a week I still get emails or tweets sent to me saying, so, Puzzle Agent 3? ? And I would love to do more of those games. I feel like we just barely began to tap into what that world was and is. And, you know, speaking to creating that vibe, that sense of a place is what's most interesting to me, whether it's in a game or a film. And yeah, Puzzle Agent tapped into something. Again, you know, I didn't quite know it when we began making it, what it would be, but once that game was finished, it's like, wow, yeah, this is something special and there's something unique to this world and I would love to continue more of it. So we'll see what can get achieved, but I would love to make more Puzzle Agent games.
Is there a Puzzle Agent story bible?
Not really, no. We, you know, it's funny, when I worked on that first game, I worked a lot with Sean Vanneman and Jake Rodkin, who are now both at Campo Santos, and Jake in particular, well, actually both Jake and Sean, I mean, I had kind of created this tone, this, I guess, Grickle universe through the comics and the animated shorts I'd been doing on YouTube, but I'm not a terribly analytical person. I don't spend a lot of time, even though I probably should, stepping back and really figuring out what things I'm doing consistently and how certain rules have sort of formalized, whether I'm aware of it or not. But when we started working on Puzzle Agent, man, I would get emails from Jake all the time saying, this part here that you suggested for the plot, that's not really very Grickle. And then he would like break it down as to why that didn't actually work within the damn universe I made. And I could never argue it. It's like, yeah, Jake's right. I guess that's a no-no. I won't do that. Okay, so it was kind of eye-opening for me to realize that I had unknowingly created a lot of parameters that at that time I was sort of unaware of.
So you're saying that you have your own version of Puzzle Agent 3, and so is Jake Rodkin.
Yeah, I'm going to have to be, if this project, if more Puzzle Agents ever get underway, I'm going to have to be on the phone with Jake a bit.
To have him give you the okay for story beats.
He's got to go over it, make sure that it works for my universe.
I also briefly want to go back to the previous question about like using words to express an idea. Mm-hmm. And for both of you, maybe it doesn't matter, but do you think that if something could be explained through gameplay, should that be done instead of using words? Or does it like depend on the situation?
Yeah, I think it probably depends on the situation. I feel like as game developers, we have a lot of tools available to us. We have visual things that happen, like once a script is locked, for example, you know, we have to come up with a different way to address maybe some playtesting feedback. So whether that's with some sort of sign or with a, you know, God forbid, you know, pop-up text at the bottom of the screen, you know, because you can have that translated later. It doesn't need to be recorded. Yeah, I mean, we have visual things that help us communicate ideas and move gameplay along. We have gameplay mechanics that we can use to let people know that maybe they've reached the edge of the world or something. I think it all depends on the situation. And like, you have to sort of take a look at your toolbox and say, what is the best way to solve this? Mm-hmm. Is it through writing? Is it through something visual? Is it through something that the programmers have to construct? Is it some sort of AI thing? Is it, you know, yeah, each situation, each universe will call for its own unique solution to it. And it's making sure that you find a solution that keeps you immersed in the experience. I remember I loved playing games when I was younger and would specifically try to do things that sort of ran counter to what you were supposed to do, and getting feedback that acknowledged what I was doing meant that somebody on that development team thought of that situation and knew that some jerk like me would be trying to break the game or just be weird and irreverent or whatever, you know. But it felt like, hey, someone knew that I was going to do this, and now I'm having that much more fun because I got feedback from the game that showed that they knew that someone would try to do this. And it, in, I guess in that situation, I was sort of pulled out of the experience, but it enriched it because it meant that I unknowingly had this like connection now to a game, and I had an experience where I felt like, hey, it's like they knew I would do this, and I loved it that much more because they made it possible for me to have that experience, and it wasn't just simply like a progression based thing that everyone was going to encounter. If that makes sense.
It does.
Okay.
Do you have any additional thoughts, Graham?
I just think whether it's film or game, it's ideally, whether it be through writing or whether it's scribbles on a napkin or whatever, it's recognizing what the best result is and utilizing whatever, like Melina said, tool you have to get to that best result. I mean, you certainly need some sort of regimented process to create and build a project, but you need to have hopefully an inherent flexibility to recognize that even though, you know, this was written, we now that we have put a voice to it, recognize that we need to visually work something out or layer something else into it. And it doesn't necessarily need to be solved by writing more script. It actually just needs a few storyboards or some drawings or some posing that would work to translate it to the animator. Like there just hopefully is always enough flexibility in the process to allow you to solve problems in a variety of ways and not be completely regimented that one way works for all things.
Yeah, and I think having enough time and money to implement all that stuff or have time to experiment is super important, but unfortunately it's not common in the industry.
It's never a reality, really. Yes, you're always running out of time and money.
Working at Leica, or having worked at Leica now, where you have hundreds of people, right?
Yep.
Do you think you've learned stuff now that you could apply back to working at video games?
Totally. Yeah, I mean, huge things. I mean, already going back, I'm back in the development department at Leica, and so I've been storyboarding and just doing concept art for projects, and man, the experience of having worked on the Box Trolls, it's like my storyboarding has definitely changed in a good way. I just am much more aware of compositions and depth of field and a lot of things that I just hadn't quite considered or was as acutely aware of before doing that stint. I mean, there's just so many layers of so many hands that all have different dependencies. And as long as it doesn't handcuff you and completely freeze you up, it's good to be aware of those things.
Yeah.
And I think all of those things, again, are just visual problem solving, and that completely applies to games as well.
And like, same thing with Melina, or somewhat similar. Is there anything that you learned about storytelling and narrative at Delphine?
Well, I think for me, one of the reasons why I love working at Delphine so much is that there is a story and a narrative, and that it's one of the things that we're known for. And so I want to fight for it, and I want to honor it, and I want to make it the best that it can be. And so that means, you know, giving Tim the space to write and purposely not talk to him for a long time, because I feel like when he thinks of my face, he thinks of deadlines, which is maybe not the best association. I want to have fun time association with my face. But yeah, it's that I that I want to give him the space to be creative, to have these ideas marinate in his head. And that when I do come to him and say, these are the things we need to accomplish by these dates, he knows that I mean it, that I'm not like just arbitrarily going into producer mode and saying, well, I need you to do this. And, you know, because I like issuing commands, I don't. I just know that from the downstream dependencies, these are the things that need to get done, and these are the dates by which they need to get done. And so I guess I come from it more of like this, I'm always in awe of people who can write and people who can create a universe just through words. And then, of course, I'm in awe of the people that bring that universe to life in a game. And I just want my part of it to be that that I'm going to be the champion for that narrative, and that however it, you know, whatever I need to do in order to make sure that it happens is sort of how I see my job. So, like, have I learned anything? I've just learned ways to do that better. That's what I've done. I'm not a better writer. I'm just a better appreciator of writing.
So you don't have like a game you want to pitch at Amnesia Fortnite?
Oh, I've had ideas for sure. You know, it's hard. I'm off site. So I think that I would have to just plan to be there for 2 weeks, which is a little bit tricky when you have two small children. I could make it happen. But I feel like I would have to do a lot more work in order to get it to a pitchable state. And I don't have time to do that.
Understandable. Graham, to jump back to the working at Leica question, were there any parallels with the problems that you encounter at Leica that were similar to working in game development?
Yeah. You know, a lot of it is just a crazy dance of tracking assets and making sure that things keep on schedule, and there's a lot of similarities between games and film. I think one thing that struck me as a real similarity was set design and how much, you know, because we're a stop motion studio, we're making physical sets and we have our characters, our puppets, and all these sort of problematic, unforeseen things that always happen with interaction between a puppet and a set. It reminded me of a lot of stuff that we went through working on games. I remember actually working with Kevin Bruner years ago on Obi-Wan Xbox, and just, man, always wrestling with the physical realities of, like, once a level was designed up and actually began to exist where you could run a character through it, there was always crazy stuff that just didn't line up in terms of proportions and just problematic things that just nobody could have foreseen until you physically ran that character around in the space and started to understand that, ooh, this is, we're going to have to tweak this a little. And it wasn't quite obviously on the level. We certainly do as much pre-planning as we possibly can in stop motion before it gets to the point of someone building and finalizing a set out there. But there's a lot of back and forth between the puppet department and the set department to make sure that if a character is going to be picking up this prop, how does that look proportionally to the scale of his hand, and does this all this stuff line up, and you know, you have sort of universal rules of scale, but they don't always perfectly work with every single situation that arises when you're making the film. And the same thing with making the games. I mean, there's just a lot of, I don't know, I guess spatial relations that, as much planning as you do up front, are always hard to see until you're actually at that moment of them interacting. And I felt like that was a real similarity between certainly a stop motion movie and designing a game.
And what are the largest differences you've seen working in stop motion and in game development?
The biggest thing that struck me when I first started working on Coraline as a storyboard artist, because I'd been out of the film industry, TV industry, for over a decade, and I'd gotten used to the pace, I guess, of the video game world. There's a sense when you're working in video games of, like, the ground is always shifting underneath your feet. I mean, it constantly evolves. Everybody's the platforms keep changing. They keep upgrading. The programming language keeps shifting. We kept moving from one software to the next each project. So there was always a lot of fast change happening. I felt like every other week there were new acronyms for things I had no idea about. It was just always, this language was always kind of evolving at a really breakneck pace. And then when I was working at Leica on Coraline, this is going to sound really disrespectful, but it just was like, whoa, I'm back into like dinosaur land. Like a lot of people didn't know how to use, they were uncomfortable even using their email on their computer. Like there was a lot of things that were super old school that just had not shifted in the film industry. I mean, there's plenty of things that have been changed and evolved, and the film industry certainly evolves a lot always, but not at the same rate and not with this horribly unnerving feeling of like the way a film is distributed and the way a film is seen does not change at the pace that video games do.
No.
And that is just like, you know, world-changing kind of pace that happens in video games doesn't seem to happen in the same way in film.
I feel like with people who don't know about game development, that they have no idea that roughly like for every game, the companies are inventing new technology based, like new systems for how to make their game. Like it's like inventing a new camera for every movie you shoot.
Yes. Yeah.
A new film stock.
Yeah. New film stock and like set construction material.
Yeah. But on the flip side of that, it's funny, you know, all the years I worked in video games, there's always whether it's spoken or unspoken, there's just the undisputable knowledge that the games sort of begin and end with the programming staff. The programmers will ultimately dictate what the final product will be. Everything comes through them, and they present it in the way it will be presented. So as an artist, I mean, everybody's role is incredibly important on any project, but as an artist, there was always compromises that had to be made aesthetically, artistically, to accommodate what program-wise we were going to be able to do, what the engine was going to be able to handle and how it was going to be done. And it was good and bad because, you know, when the game came out and some stuff looked a little janky, as an artist, as an animator, you'd be like, yeah, well, they effed up the frame rate and they told us to remove frames out of this thing and blah, blah, blah. And it's the programmers kind of squished that and blah, blah, blah. And like, you know, there was always a little bit of an out because it always came down to the programmers and what they, you know, what the compressed files ended up looking like in the actual engine. And then I get into film, back to film, and suddenly there are no excuses artistically. I mean, it kind of begins and ends with the art team. There is no cop-outs anymore. It's gonna look as good as you can make it, because it's all on you to make it look that good. And so that was I was happy for the opportunity, but I was also kind of a little terrified because I'd lost my little cop-out.
And I also want to say that, like, I know that what Graham was referring to on, you know, on these video games and this sort of us versus them attitude between artists and programmers
a little bit,
but one of the reasons why I love Double Fine so much is that there is none of that. It is all like, we're going to do this. And it didn't matter if you were an artist or a programmer or you were the office assistant. It's like, we all were in it together. And I think that, you know, like our programmers love being challenged by our art directors to like make the shit even more beautiful. It's pretty amazing. But yeah, I have had it. Definite experiences where there was more animosity between the various development, like disciplines within a development team. And I love that that doesn't exist at Double Fine.
So then who has the final say if not the programmers?
The project lead or...
Tim.
Or a publisher if it's a publisher deal. But again, you know, that's an interesting problem to solve, is like, you know, figuring out like, you know, how are we going to get it to be the best that it can be before it's, you know, ripped from our hands and released to the world?
And speaking of lots of information related to the world, we're going to get a bit technical at this towards the end, but Melina, you're often dealing with tens of thousands of individual spoken lines, which are often updated very quickly. How do you manage all the files and data and keep it organized and tracked?
Because I have an awesome dialogue database that does everything. I would never have been able to do Brutal Legend. I mean, because there were over 35,000 lines of dialogue for each language, and we voice localized. It was crazy. I don't think I slept very much during Brutal Legend. I was a little bit stressed out, but you know, we have a dialogue database that tracks everything from, like, once it's in that system, it has a unique line code ID. I know exactly if it, you know, if it's unrecorded, if it's, like, sometimes we'll do, like, text to speech, or we'll do scratch, or it's final. Maybe we have to re-record. I mean, we've got different flags that get set. There's really great logging information. I know I can check the logs to see what has changed, what do we need to re-record. So that's it. If I didn't have that, I'd be screwed. But I love that thing. It's amazing. And, you know, we've gone through a few different iterations of it. It became on Psychonauts just by necessity of where we were. And when I joined the company, I had to be the only person that managed all of that stuff, just because we had no real system in place, but we kind of put together a really quick system that would just allow me to track things a little bit more easily. And then that database has gone through a few iterations now. The most recent one done a couple of years ago by Paul Dubois, who is amazing. And it's now a tool that it may have originally started as something just for me, but a lot of people on the team use it. The animators use it to look at, to see, like, you know, what WAV files they need to use for their cutscenes. We're able to just export from the database chunks of dialogue that can immediately just be, like, stubbed in, and you've got the, you know, for interactive dialogue. So it's just, it automates a lot of things. We can do string tables, you know, which display subtitles. It's pretty sweet, and it's awesome. And if I didn't have that, I would be totally screwed.
It's something that makes sense. Like, when we first started working in games, we didn't really think about what would we use to write in, like, oh, do we just use Final Draft or, like, Word, then just give it out to someone? No. It's Excel and spreadsheets and extensive documentation, and which makes sense, but it's surprising oftentimes people who don't know the industry that well, or even people who do know the industry but not writing.
Yeah, and I think, so we shared with you our Excel template, which then I think that's, like, you guys just used it, like, no problem. And Brad, I think, was responsible. I think Brad was the one who imported all of the dialogue. I had very little interaction with it, but he never complained about it. So you guys must have followed the template perfectly, which is
good.
Rare.
And now we're going to come to our last real question.
Oh, no.
For both of you. Where do you see the industry moving forward, or where do you want it to go forward from now?
Well, I know for me personally, you were talking earlier about the, you know, the oddity of the existence of a mid-range company like Double Fine. And I feel like, you know, the video game industry, again, similar, reflects a lot of what the film industry is like, where you've got huge companies with huge budgets that make their attempt to take, you know, the biggest slice, if not all the pie for that year in terms of the money to be made, and leave barely anything left for anyone else. But as much as that's become the model of that exists these days, there's steadily always a group of small independent films and small independent games companies, and they're the ones that, you know, from what I can see, do the most interesting work. They're the ones always pushing the envelope and trying to find different ways to express themselves within the industry. And for me, it's like I just want to see more small independent stuff continue to thrive, whether it is in film or whether it is in games. It's just like that's where the really creative stuff happens usually. And, you know, every now and again, those small guys get a decent amount of success and then get handed a big bag of money to make something bigger. But again, once things get past a certain size, there's a lot more things they have to adhere to and a lot more people they have to answer to. And so, yeah, the creative aspect of it kind of dilutes a bit. So, yeah, I hope that there continues to be and hopefully grows the contingent of people that are making smaller games and just more interesting ideas.
Yeah, I feel like I've got nothing to add to that. That's it exactly. I just want to see creative and interesting things. I mean, I have so little free time that I want something that's going to feel rewarding and a good use of my time. And, you know, it is the smaller people that are free, like the smaller companies that are free from some of the kind of large layers of red tape that are able to kind of cut through the noise and just give you the straight rewarding experience. That's what I would want. Whether it's going to happen, I don't know.
We'll see.
But I think that's going to do it. So before we wrap up, where can people find you two on the internet? Melina, I know that's
nowhere.
It's nowhere. Right?
So
right.
We'll just be Graham then. Yeah.
So Graham, you don't have a Twitter account, I think.
I do.
Do either of you have Twitter accounts that people can follow?
Yeah, sorry, I have a Twitter. Yeah, I have a Twitter account. I mean, if you look up Grickle on Twitter, you will certainly find me.
We will link it in the show notes.
And you also have your
a YouTube channel page, yep. Grickle.
Are you posting new stuff on there, or is it mostly on Vine right now?
No, I've been doing Vine as well lately. I've been having a lot of fun doing that because, again, the parameters of like 6 seconds is like fascinating to me to try to like come up with a concept that you can actually get and understand and hopefully get entertained by within 6 seconds is kind of, it's awesome. I'm kind of addicted to the whole thing.
It's so good.
Well, thanks. I'm glad you're enjoying it. So I've been doing the Vine stuff once a week. I try to put a new one up, and I have so far stuck to pretty much a new cartoon once a month on YouTube lately. It's been one of the benefits of not directing a movie is that I have a little bit of free time again, and there's a lot of ideas that sort of piled up over the last few years that I'm finally getting a chance to do again. So yeah.
Belita, since you can't plug yourself, are there any stuff, like projects you want to plug right here?
No.
Okay.
Nothing?
No. I mean, okay, so, you know, fund our Psychonauts 2 fig campaign, please. I have been waiting over 10 years to go back to that world of Psychonauts. I am so excited at the possibility to go back to that world and work with all those great voice actors again and bring those worlds to life. So I guess I want to plug that, please.
That's a good plug. I'll put a note in the show notes.
Oh, and more Puzzle Agent. That's
what oh yeah, oh plug, yeah,
right?
More yeah.
Right.
Let's build a grassroots campaign for Puzzle Agent.
The campaign starts here.
Okay.
You heard it here first.